History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We aim to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, we end up educated, we're always entertained, and if we're paying close enough attention, I'm pretty sure we become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If I ask you what this weekend is, you might say Valentine's Day, but it's also the start of a very significant week that aims to preserve a unique element of World War II history. It was on February 19, 1942, that President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, which led to the forced incarceration of more than 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. Day of Remembrance ceremonies are taking place this weekend and in the days ahead. And in honor of that, today's episode will feature the memories of three of the more than 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry who served at our armed forces in World War II. We begin with Sherman Kishi, one of 6,000 who served in the military intelligence service during the war. I asked him if he had a memory of December 7th, 1941 in his native Livingston, California.
Yes, very clearly. You know, I was playing tennis in high school, and I was on the high school team, and so we practiced a lot of tennis. And this was early Sunday morning. There were four of us that went to play at the high school tennis courts to try to improve our game. And we were playing at the high school tennis courts, and as we were playing there, a car stopped by the side of the road. There were two or three men in the car, I don't remember, but they opened their windows and started to curse at us and call us all kinds of names, and it just really made us feel bad. And so, of course, we quit very shortly and went home and came home. And when we came home, we heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had happened. And that was a change for all the United States and all the world, really, basically. But I think maybe a little bit more for some of us of Japanese ancestry in the United States.
You were born here. Did you have family in Japan that you were in contact with at all?
You know, of course, I was young yet. I was 16 years old when this happened. And my father and mother used to have contact with the family in Japan, but we had never, ever seen them, only heard of them occasionally. And I think my mother went to visit the family way back in 1934, but my father had never gone back to Japan, but he was still in communication with them. So, yes, most of our relatives were in Japan.
When you went to school the next day, what was that like, the day after Pearl Harbor?
You know, the day after Pearl Harbor is a difficult one to remember, but I don't think anything really basically happened at school. The kids were okay. They didn't bother us particularly. Later, as we continued in school, though, there were some incidents that became very onerous to us, and one of them was with one of the teachers that we had at the high school.
What happened?
Well, the family that lived where we live now, this place here, they moved out after 9066 when the Japanese people could still move out of state. And they were going to go live with a daughter that lived in Denver. After the family moved, they sent me a letter, asked for me to pick up their fishing gear because they were going to go fishing in Colorado. And so I came to the house or the garage where the fishing gear was, and I took it home and I sent it off to them. And the person that was running the ranch here for them was one of the teachers, and he just really got onto me at school and was not pleasant at all. And so that was one of the incidents that happened.
So you started to notice people's attitudes toward you and other Japanese Americans change a little bit?
I think it changed a little bit. We went on to school after 9066 until about May. And then in May of that year, 1942, the orders came out, and there were posters on the telephone poles and fence posts that told us that we had to go to an assembly center. At that stage, we quit school and got prepared to have to leave. So that's what happened during that period of time.
And you tell that very matter-of-factly, but I'm sure at the time that that was quite a shock to you and had to be pretty emotional to be a 17-year-old kid and being told the place you've lived your whole life, you're not welcome anymore.
Yeah, that it was very much so. It was particularly difficult, I think, for our parents. You have to remember that our parents were quite young yet. Many of the parents were in their 40s, late 40s, and in their 50s. And so they were in the prime of their life, and they had farmed here all their lives, and all of a sudden everybody had to leave. So I know that once this had happened, they became so fearful of anything that was Japanese that I remember anything that we had in the house that looked a little bit Japanese-y, as much as we could, we destroyed, buried, or burned. And that happened to all the families in the area. So that's the kind of thing that happened during that period of time, yeah. And, you know, interestingly, they gave us this notice about 3 weeks before we had to go. The day that we went on was my 17th birthday, so I remember it very vividly. This was May the 13th of 1942, and that's the day we went into the Assembly Center in Merced.
Which is where the Merced County Fairgrounds are now?
Yes, it's where the fairground is now. We have put up a monument there in memory of that with all the names of the people that are on a wall. So that's where we got sent in. And I remember mostly being put onto buses at our church. And then we went on the bus to Merced. And we went to the, it used to be the armory there, right on 17th Street, and it's still there. And they took us there, and the first time we got there, we got out of the bus right in front, and there was a gentleman who was a dentist from San Francisco that spoke to us and told us that we had to behave and do what they asked us to do, and basically that's what we did and went into the Assembly Center, which was mostly prepared at that time.
How scared and unsettled were you? Because, I mean, that seems like a pretty imposing and uncertain future you were facing.
You know, when you're young like that, you don't think of that as much. But I'm sure that the parents were very upset. For some of us who were at that age, were young teenagers yet, it was sort of fun because we never met so many Japanese people in our lives. And very shortly after going into the camp, we had some very well-educated people who had gone to college, unable to get jobs because jobs weren't available to people of Japanese descent. And so they were well-educated, and they immediately started things within the camp. And one of the things that started was baseball. And baseball became a very popular pastime in Merced Assembly Center as it was in the later relocation camps. So there were things like talent shows. I remember very vividly one talent show that we went to that had a young lady from Walnut Grove who had a beautiful contralto voice, and one of the most popular songs that was sung at the time was God Bless America. Can you imagine? Yeah, that's what happened during those days, yeah.
And the irony, huh? God Bless America when you're basically being held prisoner by America.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But we didn't think of it that way, I guess.
Have you seen the film American Pastime?
I'm not sure.
It's about baseball in the internment camps during World War II.
Yes, I have seen that. Yes, I have seen that. Yeah, there was a gentleman in Fresno who was a very strong advocate of baseball. He was a very good baseball player. He played against Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and some of those guys.
Kenichi Zenimura.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I read his book. Uh-huh. and he became a very dominant in baseball in Poston at one of the camps. All of this area was sent to Amachi, Colorado. Camp Amachi, it was called. It's right at Grenada, Colorado, which is in the southeastern corner of Colorado.
And what was life like there?
Like every other camp, it was in the most desolate place that they could find. Really, I think it was the most desolate place that they could find in Colorado. And they had trouble finding places for these camps. We know that it was cold in the winter. It was dusty because almost all the camps were made by dozing off the sagebrush wherever it may be. That was included Topaz, included Heart Mountain. All the camps were the same, and all the Arizona camps were all the same. One of the most violent and worst thing that we remember is the dust storms that we used to have because they were so bad. But we all lived through that, eventually made the relocation camps a livable place. They planted trees and planted gardens, and things changed in those camps.
And how did it come about that you decided to go fight for the country that was holding your family hostage?
In 1942, after 9066, there was still a draft going on, of course, and they changed the status of all people of Japanese ancestry from a 1A status to a 4C status, which was an enemy alien status. So we were no longer eligible for the draft. So I, in 1942 and 43, I finished my high school. And during that period of time, they came in to recruit for the 442nd. And I was not 17 yet, so I couldn't get into the service at that stage. But just before I graduated, they also came in to recruit for MIS. And I studied a little bit of Japanese in the camp. I had a very, very smattering of Japanese in the community before the war, but very little. And so I studied a little bit in camp, learned a little bit of the alphabet, basically. And when they came in, they accepted me. I had talked to my father about this, and I told him that I wanted to go. And he said, this is your country. You go right ahead and do what you think is best. So my father approved my going as well.
And did your brother go in before or after you?
No, my brother is 4 years older than I am, but he had been going to University of California before the war. And my father became sick in 1941, and so he had to come back and help run the farm. And of course, the war happened, and so we all went to the camps. And as soon as he was able, he went to go back to college to try to finish his college. And he went back to Maryland, University of Maryland, and was enrolled there, and was going to school there. And the draft began in 1944. And I had volunteered into the service and got into the service in November of 1943. So I was in before he got in. He got drafted shortly after the draft began. So he came in 1944 into the service.
Yeah, once they took so many casualties overseas, they realized they could draft the people they had declared as enemy aliens after all, huh?
Well, I guess that's what happened. By then, you know, the 100th Battalion that came out of Fresno had done a tremendous job in Italy, and they needed lots of replacements. When they came in to recruit for the 442, which the 100th became part of, there were many of them that joined at that time. Most of the people that joined when they first came in to recruit were volunteers, but later they were drafted and put into the service, and most of them went into the 442.
And that 442nd Regimental Combat Team, of course, is legendary for its courage, its bravery, the amount of decorations per capita blows everything else away in World War II. And you mentioned you were too young to join the 442 when they came through. Had you been old enough, do you think you would have?
I probably would have, yes, because I had many friends that did. So, yeah, I probably would have joined if I was old enough.
You had many friends that joined. How many of those friends came home?
In our small community, we lost three in Italy and France. And so that's a pretty good percentage of young men that we lost in Europe with the 442.
Have you ever thought about that? That had you been able to join the 442nd and went over there, whether or not you would have survived?
Oh, yeah. I've thought about that many times. But I had a brother-in-law married to my youngest sister. That's before he's married. He was in the service and was sent over there. But he survived through all the battles, and he was a company runner. And a company runner's job was the communication between the front lines and the company. So he was in a very dangerous position, but he survived without a scratch through all that. And so you never know, you know, when that happens, it just happens. So you can't tell what's going to happen.
No, you can't. And, of course, you didn't serve in the 442nd, but I imagine you still take some pride in what those people who were facing similar circumstances as you were did accomplish. When you hear someone talk about today that phrase, go for broke, does it mean something to you? And if so, what?
That phrase means a lot. That means you do everything that you possibly can to do whatever you're doing. The young men that were my friends who were in MIS, there were a number of them killed as well in the Pacific. And they did a tremendous job over there. I had a good friend that ended up in Burma as part of the Marrow Marauders. And he went through that campaign, and he survived through it. There was a lot of things that happened in the Pacific as well as in the 442 in Europe.
Well, and I want to hear about what you did. And some folks might not know what MIS stands for. That's Military Intelligence Service?
That's correct. Yeah, Military Intelligence Service is what we were in. You know, when I got out of school, I had to go to basic training after that, after I learned my Japanese. And so by the time I was eligible to go overseas, it was starting to get a little late in the war. And I was ready in 1945, finally. after basic training and after my training. I went through a 9-month program of learning Japanese.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, was that ever hard? Can you imagine getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and getting ready for reveille and all that, and then going to class at 8 o'clock, staying in class until 4 o'clock, and then having your military things after that? And then we went back to classes at 7 o'clock at night, and we stayed there until at least 9. Wow. And so we had all that time to learn the Japanese language, and it was not easy, and we didn't have enough time. So we used to put flashlights under the blanket. We used to go to the latrine where there's light, and we used to study so we could learn enough to get by. Yeah, it was the toughest schooling that I ever went through.
I know you lived it, and it's easy to maybe in retrospect not read too much into it. But I think a lot of people that didn't go through what you went through think, where do you find the motivation to put in that kind of effort, again, for a government, for a country that is holding your family prisoner, as you know, that you've had to move away from the land that you've had your entire life, and here they are in this internment camp? How did you get past that mentally and emotionally, and how would you describe the mindset you did have?
You know, I didn't think about that very much, frankly. This was our country. This is the only country that we knew, and this is the only country we're loyal to. All we thought about was doing what we needed to do for our own country. We knew that Japan, our folks came from Japan, but that really didn't cut any ice with us because we never knew any of those people over there. And so they became our enemies, basically.
And that attitude you described, did you feel like that was pretty common among the other men that you were training with?
Yes, I think so. I think so. Although you have to realize that when we went to the MIS, there were many young men who were called Kibes. And Kibe means a young person of the ancestry who were sent back as citizens from the United States to Japan to be educated. And so there were many of those people that were in MIS. And some of them had some completely different feelings about it. There were some of the Kibes who were very hopeful that Japan would win. But basically, they were very loyal to the United States. And most of the translating and interpreting that was done in the Pacific was basically done by the Kibes. The Niseis were not very strong in Japanese, and so they did most of the English writing that had to be done on the reports and things. And so you have to give a lot of credit to those young men who learned the language in Japan and came back and fought for the United States.
A lot of people don't even realize how much of a challenge it was for a lot of Japanese-American families to get their land back, if that was even an option. In your case, here you are on the property where you were born. How did that work out? How was it that your family came to recover this land after the war was over?
My family was not part of the cooperatives, so we asked our high school ag teacher, who we knew was a very nice gentleman, to run our farm for us, and his name was Eldon Callister. He ran our farm for us during that period of time, and the person that was what we call the chicken doctor, because we had chickens across the street there, egg-laying chickens. Mm-hmm. And he took over our house and continued that business there. And I think they all did quite well farming for us during that period of time because they left some money in the bank for us when we came back. So we had some very fortunate friends to have. And I didn't realize that Eldon Callister was a Latter-day Saint at the time, but he was. And he was a very honest man and did a great job for us. So we were very fortunate.
And I guess at that time, maybe you didn't realize how fortunate you were. But in the years since, as you've met other Japanese-American veterans, has it struck you that your situation and how that worked out for you was a lot better than a lot of Japanese-American families experienced?
There's no question about that. Most of the people that lived in the cities lost their businesses, lost everything that they had, and they didn't have too much to begin with. So when they came back, they had to start all over again, and it was very difficult for them. I have a friend who had a father that was put into the camps along with us. He couldn't find a job. He just really became mentally distraught as a result of that. And this happened to many people, I think, during that period of time. It was a tough time for people to come back to the California after the war. It was very difficult.
That's the late Sherman Kishi, and his perspective resonates as we approach this year's Day of Remembrance for Americans of Japanese ancestry. Check online for Day of Remembrance observations in your area, and if you've never engaged with the Go for Broke National Education Center, this would be the perfect time. There's plenty for you to explore at gopherbroke.org, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of this week's Day of Remembrance, an annual observation for Americans of Japanese ancestry, helping to ensure that they never forget, and neither do we, not only the internment of 120,000 people, mostly American citizens, here in the States during World War II, but also the military service of 33,000, many of whom had families held behind barbed wire. Denver, Colorado native Sam Terasaki served in the 100th Battalion and later the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. But we're going to pick up his story on the day that life changed for every single American.
December 7th, I was out rabbit hunting with my brother, one of my brothers, and his friend Joe Morshige, who was killed in the war, I think in Italy or France. We went rabbit hunting with our 22 rifles. And it was a weird thing. We actually went around the outskirts of what was a new air base called Laurie Field. It had moved here from Illinois and relatively new. I think it moved here sometime in 1937 or something. We didn't know anything about the start of the war until we got home. But in hindsight, I imagine three guys with rifles in a... trying to tell officials that we were hunting rabbits when we're circling around a military base.
A base on high alert because they just heard that Pearl Harbor was attacked.
I don't know whether they were on high alert or not.
Wow. I know we're going to hear some stories that are going to amaze us at how you survived in Europe, but it's somewhat surprising you survived that if you're a young Japanese-American with a gun by an Air Force base. So then you get home, and you hear it on the radio, or your folks tell you?
Yeah. And then I don't know how long later, whether it was a day or 2 days or a week, but the FBI came to our home, interviewed each one of us separately.
Wow.
I was 17 years old.
You're a 17-year-old kid getting grilled by the FBI?
Scared as hell. And, you know, you hear a lot about the FBI, and I guess one of the big radio shows at that time was Gangbusters.
Yeah. Elliot Ness and all that. Yeah. What'd they ask you? What kind of stuff were they trying to get out of you?
Well, I don't remember. I think most of it just want to know if we were loyal and what we were up to.
And you had mentioned your father had done a lot of business with businessmen from Japan.
Yeah. So I'm sure that they didn't throw him into camp, but they did throw several, like the Buddhist priests, local Buddhist priests and stuff, were sent to a separate camp.
So December 7th happens, not long after the FBI comes to your home, interviews everybody, and I'm sure you're afraid of what's going to happen. But then a couple months later, the president issues this 9066, this executive order, basically saying that if you're a Japanese-American on the West Coast, you're an enemy alien, and you're out here in Colorado. Were you concerned that they were going to put you in a camp, put your whole family in a camp?
No, it never bothered, never struck me. I really don't know why. Might have been because we didn't live in the Japanese community in Denver. We lived, I think there was only two families that lived in East Denver then. No, it didn't concern me at all, although I was aware of them being thrown into camp, yeah.
Did that make you angry to know that these people, just because of their last name or their appearance?
No, just wondered why. I didn't face any discrimination for the few months later that I was in high school until I graduated in June of 42. Although some of the fellow students just maybe were afraid to get too involved with me. All of my friends were of Caucasian descent. A lot of my closest friends were actually Jewish kids that went to the school. I don't remember any of them ever coming up and say, "Sam, don't worry, we're with you," and stuff like that. But on the other hand, they never turned their backs on me either. So I was fortunate in that sense.
And how'd you end up in the Army?
Well, I was drafted. Do you know the story about being designated an enemy alien?
Yeah.
Well, that's it. See, in 1942, I should have been drafted right away. I was 17, 18 then, 1A classification. It was in the spring of 42. They changed the classification from 1A to 4C.
Right.
I didn't fight it. I'm 4C. I'm 4C.
It didn't bother you that this country you're born in is calling you an enemy alien and unfit to serve?
No, I said to hell with them.
You just stay out of the way and keep your nose down.
I decided I was going to work a couple of years and go to university. Mm-hmm. If they wanted me, they have to come after me. I wasn't about to volunteer, mainly because I knew I had a hunch of where we would end up.
Really? What was that hunch?
That we couldn't join the Air Force, we couldn't join the Navy, couldn't join the Marines or the Merchant Marine. We were headed for the Army and the part of the Army that I didn't like. If I had had a chance to, actually, after I was inducted, I volunteered for the Air Force, but they went to. So I volunteered for the Navy. I hate ships, but I volunteered just to stay out of being designated infantryman.
Right, because you knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But you're saying you saw that coming. You figured that you guys would be the expendable ones?
Well.
Or that they were going to need some bodies at some point?
You don't want to go in the infantry during a hot war. They were so hard up for replacements for the 442nd and the 100th Infantry Battalion that from the day I was inducted until I first heard my enemy shell coming over my head was less than 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that was May of 44. Went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi for basic training in June of 44, and they sent us home for 2 week furlough. While I was home, one of the cadre from Mississippi, who was a Colorado boy, came home and called me up, and I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. And he says, "Sam, you better be sure and tell your folks hello, because as soon as you get back, you're going to be shipped overseas." That's first I heard of that. And it turned out that was the way it was. After my furlough was over, I went back to Mississippi, and they'd already had the mattress bag, and you fill it up, and we were shipped out on a troop train to Camp Shanks, New York.
You shared with us how you were able to avoid the internment your time here in Denver. You've got a couple of years of freedom that a lot of Japanese Americans didn't have.
No, they didn't.
But then you get to Camp Shelby, and you're around a whole lot of Japanese Americans who have been in the camps.
When I was inducted at Fort Logan in Colorado, there might have been a dozen in our group, I'm not sure. Half of them were people that grew up in the farm communities north of Denver, a couple of whom I knew. The other half came out of one of the relocation camps, Camp Amachi, which is in southeastern Colorado.
Right.
I made friends with one of the fellows that came out of Amachi. I didn't know him from Adam, and he lived in California before the evacuation. So we had a friendship until we both ended up in the 100th Battalion when we were shipped overseas. I was in A Company and he was in C Company. We survived France, and when we were shipped back to Italy, well, he was killed back in Italy.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Bob Suoyoka. I have a picture of him, and I never have been able to locate any member of his family. You do what you're supposed to do. I wondered why it was me and not the guy next to me that got wounded or killed. I was fortunate that I got through the war without a scratch. In retrospect, I think being classified 4C may have saved my life, because I would have been drafted right away and would have been ended up in the 442nd very early on and shipped overseas when the regiment went overseas. As it was, by the time I joined as a replacement, I had missed one of the big battles, the rescue of the Lost Battalion and right. the capture of these two French towns, Biefontaine and Bruyères.
And that's the signature achievement of the 442, or the one that gets the most publicity, because
yes, right.
there were more members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team killed and wounded than there were mostly Caucasian soldiers from that Lost Battalion rescued.
Yeah. Some of the fellows that when I joined up, they had just pulled back from the front lines, and one of the fellows whose brother I had taken basic training with, we looked him up, and sure enough, he was in the medics, and you could see in his eyes the hell that he'd gone through, because I had seen him in Camp Shelby before they shipped out as a replacement themselves. He was in the group of replacements just before me.
So when you saw him over there, you saw a different look in his eye.
Oh, absolutely. You could see that. You could tell that he was through hell.
What was your first taste of combat and what this is really going to be like?
Well, at that time, it was after they'd pulled back from the front lines, and we were so depleted in manpower that they gave us easy duty in southern France. That was from November until the next spring in March of 45. Yeah, all the time our particular company were in the Maritime Alps, I guess is what they called it. It was right on the border of Italy and France.
Right.
And being in a weapons platoon, my job each night was to go up to the outpost on the border and look down into Italy and man a machine gun just in case the Germans came, tried to attack there. Although I was a mortarman by, what do they call it, MOS or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then when dawn would break, well, then we'd get out of that machine gun nest and come back down the mountain to the backside, into the French side, because they knew that there was a machine gun nest there. In fact, the German artillery had a direct hit on it one day when we were out of the...
So the very position that you occupied the night before or the night after got hit?
Was it
the
daytime?
Day.
Generally, uh-huh. the Germans wouldn't, at that time, wouldn't shoot their artillery at night because it would reveal their position
right.
very precisely, where in the daytime they would shell us. And when we went up the next night, we saw the destruction. And it actually was a direct hit.
Wow.
We had a spare 30 caliber machine gun barrel there, and you hold it up and look through it, and you could see a dent on the inside where a shrapnel hit.
That's a pretty direct hit.
Pretty direct hit. General Clark had the 100th Battalion in Italy. He didn't want to give them up, but Truscott in France wanted them from the invasion of southern France and for the battle into Germany. Clark lost out. The regiment, including the 100th Battalion, was sent to France. That's when they got involved, not only in the invasion of southern France, some of the units flew into southern France on gliders.
Yeah.
Where they happened to end up rescuing the remnants of the regiment that was encircled. They were getting ready for the last offensive against the Germans, so Clark wanted the regiment back in Italy. So that's why we went from Italy to France and back to Italy, all the time in combat, and were hauled in the big open bed trucks up to the front lines and then walked the rest of the way up the hill in the dark until we were committed to battle on the morning of April 5th.
Were you prepared for what you were going to experience?
No, because I hadn't experienced anything like that where you're throwing grenades at each other. We set up our mortar in a foxhole that had been dug by American forces that were there ahead of us. My best army buddy, who was from originally from Oxnard, California, who settled in Atlanta, Georgia, Mike Doy, he and I were in the mortar squad that I was in charge of, set up our mortar, and while up above us, the guys in the rifle platoons were fighting.
So you're seeing things and hearing things and probably smelling things and experiencing things that you've never experienced before.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, but he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. It was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning of the 5th of April.
And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those that chaplains read.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got
to
be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
I've noticed a few times now that every time you refer to it, you use the verbiage, Americans of Japanese ancestry. You don't want a hyphen in there anywhere.
No.
Why is that?
I've been approached by a number of people, and because of my facial features and stuff, they say, are you Japanese? I know what they mean.
Right.
But I make it a point to say, no, I'm an American. Not to embarrass them, but what they have to realize is that America is made up of all different ethnic groups. And I'm an American, and I just happen to be an American of Japanese ancestry.
I don't want to forget to say something important. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story from your perspective. When it comes to the Americans of Japanese ancestry who served our country during World War II, what gives you the most pride, and what do you think is the biggest thing that the rest of us who weren't around then need to know and remember?
I'm glad I served. My feeling is it opened the doors for the rest of our children. They're doing things that we wouldn't even think of doing, no. So it's, life is easier, even though I know that they face discrimination once in a while. So I think we opened a lot of doors. That was because the Nisei soldiers did a good job. The guys in the MIS did a good job. The other thing is I want to make sure that this story is told over and over again, something like the Jewish Holocaust. If you don't talk about it, they're going to forget.
And it could happen again.
It could happen again. The fact that I let you interview me, and the fact that I've been interviewed before, and it's because I want the rest of the America to know what we did during the war, that we're Americans just like anyone else that was born here, even though we look different.
The late Sam Terasaki. You can link to his complete original interview as well as those with the other veterans featured today at hometownheroesradio.com. Sam talked about his friend Spud Munamori, the only American of Japanese ancestry awarded the Medal of Honor during the war. Since then, there are quite a few who've had their medals retroactively upgraded to our nation's highest military recognition. And we're going to hear some World War II memories from one of them when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring the 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry who served in World War II. Many of them among the 120,000 who were sent to internment camps in 1942. This week marks the Day of Remembrance, observed on different days in different places, so search online for observances in your area. The final veteran we'll hear from today is the late Joe Sakato, awarded the Distinguished Service Cross during the war for his courage in the campaign that came to epitomize the men of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Rescue of the Lost Battalion. Joe would have that award upgraded to the Medal of Honor about a half century after he almost died in France.
In France, we ended up in the near the Vosges Mountains of the Swiss border and the German border, foothills of the Swiss Alps, and climbing those hills is like 45-degree angle, and I had to pull on tree roots and pull myself up. Somebody else would take my pack, and somebody else. I was the last one up the hill, and when we got up top of the hill, this is going to be our first day of battle, and I was talking with one of my friends from Washington. We sat there, and we didn't know what incoming or outgoing was. When these veterans from the 442s of the 100 were fighting in Italy, they came back. I hear this, oh, then the guy says, oh, that's outgoing. Okay, next, we're talking around, and then pretty soon, boom. I picked myself up about 15 feet, 10 feet away. I got a nick in my wrist, and then in my foot, I had another nick. But I looked down, and I see my friend laying down, face down, and I turned him over, and a shrapnel grazed his jugular vein, and the blood was squirting out every time his pulse was beat. Was just stream of blood the size of a pencil would come out. And I'm trying to, my wound was nothing. So I was putting sulfur on his wound and put a pad on it and putting it too hard, and he couldn't breathe. and I had to let go, and blood was still squirting out. If I lost too much blood, he was the first to die on me.
And that was your very first day of combat?
First day of combat. The other veterans, they knew what's going on, but for me to get blown up and then see something, see my friend squirting blood, bleeding, I couldn't help him without choking him, and then I said, well, this is not for me. I don't know what I'm doing here, but we had to go. So we finally had to climb this hill and moving forward to town of Brewers, and the 3rd Battalion was down the bottom in the valley heading for Brewers, and then we heard house-to-house combat. They were fixed bayonets. So as we were marching towards the other end of the hill, the explosion goes off the top of the ridge that we were following, landmines. So we had to get on our stomach and pull out our bayonets and probe for landmines on it, inch by inch. What if I hit the trigger of the landmine? Holy mackerel. Boom. Another mine went off. Some at the top of the ridge. Well, we traveled on top of the ridge so we could look down to the left side and look down on the right-hand side. So as we traveled, they had these landmines put up. Then we finally got those out of the way, and then we got down to the end of the hill, and we're looking down at this town of Brewers, and we see a tank, German Tiger tanks going out. Hooray, they're leaving. Then he got out in the middle of the field, and he turns around, and that's funny, his barrel is facing us, and next thing I hear, boom. Then they see a ring of smoke on the end of the barrel of the tank, and then pow, hit the tree behind us. He was shooting at us. We had to run on the other side and try to dig in about 6 inches and hit tree roots and rocks. And I had to crawl into my helmet, and I said, what am I getting into now? Oh, my God. Then we finally took that hill, went to the next hill, took another hill, and we got another one. And we got up early in the morning, and they chased the Germans off this one hill. And I chased them all the way down to the bottom of the hill, and the sergeant says, come back. So I was heading back, and the German is shooting at me, and I'm shooting back at him. And then I go up, try to get back up the hill, and I go about 10 feet, and I got to rest. Go 10 more feet and rest. When I got on top of the hill, nobody was there. They thought I had joined them, and they all headed back downhill. Their eyes didn't know which way was our lines.
So you were all alone?
I was all alone by myself. And I got down, I got to the south end, the east end, left end of the hill, and I saw a big bush and 3 feet high, and I crawled inside that bush and put some branches on top of my face and nose. And I stayed there for a couple hours, and then German patrol comes by. Oh, my God. 2 more hours goes by. And I said, well, it's now 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I see our helmet, and I said, oh, that's hot. Hey, what company is this? The guy wanted to shoot me because I didn't know the password. He says, I've been up this hill for 6 hours, and I don't know where the password is now. The F Company. So they took me back and got down. As soon as I got down the hill, got the rest of the company. Captain says, 3rd Platoon, you got to go up and see this colonel. Well, I just got to join the company. Well, you got to go. So we go up. One fellow was writing up a citation for that hill because we had taken that hill in 2 hours, an hour and a half. He was writing his 3rd Platoon. So he had to join us. He put all the information in his pocket, and we get up to see this colonel, and the colonel says he wanted to see where his men were. This is the 36th Division, Texas unit, in the Howley outfit. And we go out and see somebody chopping wood on this side of the hill and somebody's chopping wood on the other side of the hill. And then we go up about 1,000 yards. Oh, sure enough, there's men were dug in, foxholes and everything. Then the lieutenant there says, go see where the Germans are at. Why should we go see where the Germans are? Why can't they go see where the Germans are at? They didn't have orders. What do you mean they didn't have orders? So we go up, go another 500 yards, and German machine gun. We hit the ground. I rolled over to the left, got behind a bush. Guy from Pueblo, Colorado was on my left side. He was out in the open. Ben Masoka was riding up a citation. He was on my right side of my head. He was out in the open. And the guy named Friday on the other side of him, he was out in the open. George put up on our left side. He looked up, first one to get to. A sniper, German sniper, had telescopic sights with crosshair. Pow! Right through the temple. First one to go. Then Ben was on the other side. He didn't have his helmet strapped on. Pow! He decreased his temple. Blood just come out, and then the helmet flew right way back. Then Friday, he looks up. He got shot. So all three guys got shot and looking for me, and I'm behind this bush, and he couldn't see me. I had to go back, and I, for just to see where the their own troops were, we had to go and find where the Germans were. We get shot. We lose three men just for nothing.
So it sounds like the message that you're getting is you guys were expendable.
That's what we were. General Dahlquist was, kept pushing, you got to move. That's why the 141st Unit of the Lost Battalion got surrounded. Because they went too fast. They were moving too fast. And the rest of the 142nd and 43rd could not rescue them. So it was up to 442 to rescue the Lost Battalion. We're on this side of the hill. We'll cross the railroad tracks and we get this order. They just pointed out that one hill, 617. It's a big rocky ledge, cliffs, and then the rest of the mountain comes down. And we had to take that hill, and how are we going to get on top of that hill? He says, well, we go around it, but we have to chase the Germans off first. So we went on trucks, and we went behind the 7th Army, was fighting the Germans. And we went behind them and got on the back side of this hill. But we stayed on the west side of the hill, down below, and at half step at a time, we marched towards this cliff area, and when we took us all night to get up so far, we got to the area. At dawn, we started our attack. Now we were behind the Germans. We surrounded the Germans, and the Germans had to get out of their foxholes and went east to the east side, and then they joined the troops that was fighting the 3rd Battalion that was going into the valley. And we finally got them down and around there. We jumped. Then artillery came in, the Germans and artillery, and so we had to jump in the Germans' foxholes. And then we waited, and pretty soon the artillery stopped. There's going to be a counterattack. So the Germans called, radioed the troops that were fighting the 7th Army to come across, and they came across. Now they came in the same area that we had come in. Now the Germans were behind us. We were being surrounded again. They were trying to chase us out of their own foxholes. And we got off so far, and then I told one of the fellows, watch out for the machine gun. So he looks up and he says, where? And he got shot. When he got shot, I crawled over and picked him up, and he died in my arms. And I says, God, I was going to get the SOB that shot him or else die trying. So I picked up my Thompson, and I crisscrossed up the hill. I went northeast one way, and then I fired. I had a Thompson submachine gun that I stole out of a Sherman tank that was crippled, and they were waiting for parts to fix it. But the troops that were from the tank were in the farmhouse talking to a farmer, and nobody was in the tank, so I crawled into the tank and pulled out the Thompson submachine gun and left my rifle. And then I was able to use it on this hill. When I fired it, it fired good straight up, and I says, oh, that's no good either. So I turned it on the side, and I started one left-hand side, and I, and it would automatically move to the right-hand side. That was real great. Mowed down a bunch of bushes, and next thing you know, I was going back and forth. When I go up to one, I fired it, and I turned it over again and run up the other way, and then I was throwing it again. The Germans that were from the 7th Army didn't know about this rocky ledge. And then when they finally got to the top of the rocky ledge, they couldn't see where they could go around it because the rest of the E Company was on the east side of it. They couldn't go there, so they dropped their rifles. I shot 6 of them, I know, but they said I shot 12 of them. And we captured 37 prisoners. They dropped their rifles because they couldn't get past that hill. And then we, therefore, we came back and we had to go to the left side hill. G Company moved over to the east end hills to chase the Germans off of the east hill down on the east side. And the 100th Battalion team came over and took over the hill 617, the east side of that hill, and then moved up towards the Lost Battalion. And we, the I Company was catching hell because they were getting shot from one hill and the other hill across crossfire. When they finally got to the Lost Battalion, 150 men, only seven of them, I Company was able to walk. K Company had 17 men. 100th Battalion had 20 men. We had 30. Arthur, we was on the east side. We didn't get as bad as the others. I got wounded, and I was headed back to the aid station. And I'm the only one there going towards the aid station, and the Germans send up a mortar shell, lands up about 10 feet away from me and picked me up and blew me closer to the aid station. Then I was 3 months in the Epinal Hospital, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And then they finally got me on a plane and went to England.
Medal of Honor recipient Joe Saccato, another example of the courage and love of country displayed by so many, rendered even more significant in the context of a country that put 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry behind barbed wire. Today we've heard some of the things that the Day of Remembrance is designed to help us never forget. I hope you can connect with an event along those lines in your community this week. And that's all the time we have on the radio today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.